Again, a very special good afternoon to each of you. And I'm very thankful for this opportunity for us to come together to try to lean forward for the advancement of prevention and early intervention. It is my intention during this short period to share perspectives and some evidence-based findings that will allow, basically, us to put a face on HIV-affected children in urban epicenters related to the HIV infection. First, I need to disclose. We'll get there. I have no relationship to disclose. And as an introduction to this very sensitive topic, I think it's very important for us to take a minute to note that HIV and AIDS is always a sensitive topic in the community. Many children in the United States have lost one or both parents to HIV. Little has been written to reflect the highly stressful conditions of children and families in which the mother has HIV/AIDS, especially during this actualized period of antiretroviral therapy. Most of the women who are living with HIV/AIDS are in the United States, as my colleagues have highlighted in some of our presentations we've received, are Black and Latino, and their children face extraordinary challenges for physical, psychosocial, as well as environmental health, as well as the adjustments for survival, and often at a very young age. We have to acknowledge that changes in the HIV pandemic have important implications for children of mothers with HIV/AIDS, particularly in the ethnic minority communities. The number of at-risk children ages 0 to 14 years whose mothers have HIV/AIDS was expected to grow over the past decade. And that bell tolls very loudly in African American and other minority communities. Research was primarily conducted at the beginning of HART. In other words, beginning early in 1999, and very little has been written past 2005 that have highlighted the issues faced by children affected by HIV and AIDS. However, we also must acknowledge that public health and social justice actions have remained limited and very inconsistent. In addition, adequate public health resources remain lacking in many minority communities, especially communities that are considered hotspots. The issues confronting children of mothers living and dying with AIDS seems to be benchmarked in a low priority ranking, and it is especially noted in the growing efforts that's directed at the state and local levels to address the demands for a national comprehensive HIV prevention plan. This is the work that is currently occurring in Baltimore and many other urban centers. Our president, President Obama, has recently sent forth the strategic plan for our nation as it relates to the establishment of a national comprehensive HIV prevention plan. And he is asking all cities, local, state agencies to really look at what should be included for your community in order to address areas that may remain still in a gap position. And it is from that position that my aim today as a public health practitioner, as well as a HIV prevention commissioner and educator, to stimulate a sense of urgency for professional attention, and that our actions should be focused on further research, policies, and updated laws that can help our children who are living and surviving as persons directly affected by HIV and AIDS. Empirical investigations conducted during those initial waves of HIV prevention research focused on assessment of risks, protective factors and processes, and adversity that was faced by families. The intent, however, today is for us to review, yes, some of the content that is provided that will help us to put a description that can support both background and contextual public health realities. It is well recognized that the length of survival of people with HIV and AIDS have increased dramatically. That is no longer a question. We know that. However, an average will not do when we know that too many individuals do not reap the benefits of treatment, and they often experience incapabilities and disabilities that alter an HIV-positive parent's abilities to provide for their children. What I'm saying is we have data before us coming from many different directions, especially from the Division of AIDS, that let us know that our young have more difficulties in tolerating treatments, that we are also confronting the fact that we have resistance to treatment. Therefore, everyone is not benefiting, and we need to keep that in front of us as we continue to look at policy development. The majority of women, 84% with HIV, are of childbearing age. They are Black and Latino, and they must, and most of them, have acquired this virus through unprotected heterosexual intercourse. The number of women, the number of new cases of HIV and AIDS among women continue to grow. The HIV epidemic is spreading at a faster rate among women, especially younger minority women. In the African-American community, there are many quote-unquote rationales for why this has continued over the past decade and a half, with the rate continuing to go up. Basically, some of us recognize and have discussed here at the conference that it is related to our correctional incarceration situation as it relates to the number of African-American men that are incarcerated and upon release immediately return to the community and therefore put Black women at higher risk. However, we're still trying to break that silence, to be able to get more of our reliable data that can help us to better understand how to curb the continuing rise among young minority women. Unmarried mothers with HIV was explored by a national representative sample that was conducted by the Department of Health and Human Services, the Division of AIDS, for policy investigation. And based on that, it revealed that the mothers are younger women, 18 to 39 years, Black, having less than a high school education, an annual income of $0 to $10,000, living in urban centers in the Northeast and Southern region of the United States, and that most definitely includes and aligns to findings in the Baltimore-Washington, D.C. corridor as other urban communities. And I think some have given some emphasis to that same type of finding within their communities upon our panel. The very nature of the despair that is present for children in urban ghettos, the status of minority children in today's America, all have a reality that can neither be ignored or denied. We are being fronted. HIV negative children of mothers with HIV positive, who are HIV positive, may be at higher risk for mental health distress symptoms. These have been manifested both as internalized, being depression and anxiety, as well as externalized, which is manifested usually in conduct problems at home and school. There is no identified public study that reports a rate of 100% disorder among a general population of children or among children in any higher risk group. Therefore, we must confront the fact that the focus should be on special population, specifically children affected by AIDS, violence, and other terminal illness or disorder. Stress emerges in the HIV family when demands exceed capabilities, especially for caring, understanding, or functioning with small HIV children. HIV negative children. The influence of an HIV positive parent's illness severity, the parent and provider perspective or perception of heart for longer life expectancy, as well as the challenges, needs that we face for more flexible state laws, can in fact mandate an intensive assessment and referral to public health services. We should expect this to help HIV negative children through a parent's serious illness or impending death. These are the areas that further research for effective program outcome measurement is required. An intensive HIV family assessment model is required to assist as well as aid health professionals to help identify the degree of chronic stress children experience in these environmental situations. Today, children affected by HIV intervention program development actions must be a focus in order for us to redirect our attention towards this special population, who should, regardless of circumstance, have an opportunity for healthful and productive living in our community. The goal must be to promote balance as well as resilience in families, which in turn will contribute to better health and functioning in HIV-affected families. Basically, when we try to look at the current status of appraisals for HIV preventive services and what those requirements would be, we find that our efforts are continually focused on breaking the silence. We're still trying to get individuals in the community to be willing to disclose. We are not in a position where we would just automatically be able to direct services where there is that greatest need. We're doing activities that would in fact support mapping and being able to identify where service provision is, but the overt manifestations of denial, grief, depression, insecurity, hopelessness, caregiver and care recipient sense of burden, and the realities of distrust of the legal system contributes to the face of children affected by HIV. So the demands for care is a model that was basically adapted for an appraisal of chronic stressors in a situational environment. And it presents four domains that influence dimensions of health for HIV negative children of mothers with HIV/AIDS. The first is the psychosocial domain, which refers to those characteristics in the environment that increases symptoms for physical and mental illness, including emotional pain, depression, separation anxiety, conduct problems, and lack of congruence in family structure. When we talk about lack of congruence, back in 1984, Aaron Antonovsky, a medical sociologist, conducted several studies regarding personality characteristics that serve to promote health. He concluded that it is a sense of coherence within an individual that produces health. The sense of coherence is comprised of three parts, mainly comprehensibility, manageability, and meaningfulness. In other words, when the world is viewed as comprehensible, we perceive it as making sense, as possessing some sort of structure and offering some level of predictability, even in the middle of chaos. We find children living in homes when their parents are very ill with the devastating diagnosis and illness of HIV infection that things become very chaos. They are not manageable. They are not in a way that one is in a position to meet the demands for survival in that stressful situation. The second relates to insecurity. This directly focuses on the characteristics that promote uncertainty of means or hopelessness for task requirements. That includes guardianship, foster care, fragmented social support, and highly relevant financial and economic instability. The third is the sense of burden. Here we are assessing what is the perceptions that advanced responses of being overextended and overwhelmed by the requirements to and for care that is experienced not only by care providers, but care recipients, and that includes grandparents, partners, friends, and kinships. And lastly, that is related directly to the law and this distrust of legal systems. This is the legal framework that is expected to guide public health actions for prevention and protection, including targeted clinical assistance, health services, schools, or faith-based, standby guardianship, provider authorization, child care continuum mandates. The legal system must function as a protective process. It must recognize the characteristics in our environment that is expected to be altered or given or even reversed. We're saying that the potential negative outcomes must be arrested and enable the children to transform. In conclusion, the recommendations are such: health professionals that are caring for the children of chronically or terminally ill parents must make note. They must, in fact, if the parent is diagnosed with AIDS, they should be assisted to create a plan for future care and custody of their children as early. We call that anticipatory guidance as it relates to community health nursing as well as public health. We're saying that public health professionals must be more vocal, must be more visible, must be ready to address the issue, that in fact we need laws that would include the provision to authorize flexible and standby guardianships and provide specific funding to facilitate planning for children with their parents who will become ill or have limited life expectancy. Civil and social justice advocates should ask state and local child health agencies to develop flexible policies that permit temporary placement of children during parental severe illness or return to children if the parent regains sufficient health. The preference, when possible, is not to separate siblings. And lastly, public health professionals should advocate for state-funded model programs that provide comprehensive HIV prevention, social support, and legal services for chronically ill HIV-infected parents, their children, and future caregivers and guardians to enhance the well-being of the children. I thank you.
Okay, that is the end of our panel today, and I thank all our panelists for a really diverse and informative group of presentations here. We do have about 10 minutes, so I can field questions from our audience, and if the panelists feel comfortable to talk loudly, they can, or they can come up here, whichever works. So we have about 10 minutes for questions. Okay, then I'll start. If I had to do this task, I get the first question, and it actually goes to Nathan. And given the committee's recommendations to not reverse the current situation in blood donation, where do we go next, and what is the future, and what are your next steps, and where do you take that?
Sure. What this requires now, because there are so many moving parts, there is one of how do you differentiate low-risk MSM, and two, how do you actually screen out high-risk heterosexuals? There's actually a number of studies that are already underway with the NIH. There's one of a very large scale. It's in the second scale. It's called the RED study, and that is attempting to figure out exactly where high-risk heterosexual people are currently donating and how we might be able to screen them out. There is then a need to do some new research, which is underway at the American Centers for Blood Research Institute, And that will be a multi-year strategy in terms of actually getting a sufficient big N of gay men to actually volunteer to donate and figure out how we can actually move that forward. So there is actually a need for a robust and very clear research agenda that outlines clear timelines and responsibilities, which should be forthcoming very soon by NIH. And if we have anything to do with it, it will be very soon. So.
Are there other questions from the audience? Yes, in the back.
For Dr. Ross-Couture, the question is, this is clearly a urgent issue. I'm just wondering, with a system that's already burdened with not giving adequate care for children who are not as specifically at risk, how is the system going to accommodate the specialized care for the children of HIV infected with AIDS?
I think the aim is to try to be able to, in an early intervention, to recognize mental health needs. I feel that most of the discussions are coming out of our pediatrician, from pediatrics perspective, because again, we are talking about very young children. The data, our problem is it is very difficult to track the children because the mother must be the marker. And unless we break the silence in regard to the diagnosis, because it is, again, denial continues to be the greatest culprit in the community. It is not easy to talk about. As I began the presentation, I tried to stress that the sensitivity of the discussion of HIV continues to be the challenge in the African American community. So trying to create environments where mental health, both of children and adult, to be given greater priority in our assessment parameters. We're not saying that the pediatrician or the immunologist would be the appropriate physicians to manage the care. We're simply saying that we do not have a system in place that mandates that intensive assessment at the point of the diagnosis if, in fact, you're caring for a child and their parents are HIV positive. It is time to have that conversation with the parent about the responsibility for making decisions about the care of their children. It cannot wait until the initiation of the treatment. Right now, we base initiation of treatment based on viral load. Well, no. Some conversations will take longer and they're more sensitive. So we cannot wait the 3 to 4 year period to really look at what are the steps based on the way our legal system is currently established.
Any other questions? Anyone else? Going once. Oh, there we go. Go ahead.
I had a question for the Shaker Prevention Center. That was an interesting project because that's funded by the SAMHSA. How many of those initiatives are funded by SAMHSA?
All of those initiatives are funded by SAMHSA. We've had SAMHSA support for the last 8 years.
And how efficient have you been? I'm actually evaluating projects somewhere else around education, and they're having difficulties around the coalition building and maintenance. So how have you all been able to kind of maintain those coalitions over that 8 year period? Is it negative community or?
Probably a little bit of both, the negative community and the sort of hands up in the air. because what's really happened is there have been a couple of high profile events that have really sort of brought people together, and I think with local coalitions, that's often what happens. The other thing that's fortunate is that the coalition was formed prior to receiving grant funding. So people were already talking, they were already working together. So with that infusion of funding, then it was, wow, all these things we've been talking about doing for such a long time, now we can actually do. And we have the structure in place and the funding and resources available to do that.
Any other questions? Okay, one more time. Going once, going twice. Okay, thanks everyone.